Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Why are the poor poor? To perhaps ask this question from a different angle, what prevents the poor from becoming wealthier? These are questions that have long held the interest of economists, political scientists, and sociologists. Now, granted, if one takes a very long-term view of human history, dating back tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years ago, our species has largely lived in a state of subsistence and/or abject poverty. It has only been in recent centuries that we have witnessed an amazing explosion of living standards around the world. But not every population has shared in this increase in economic growth equally. Some nations remain incredibly poor. And even some nations that are experiencing a rapid rise in gross domestic product, such as India, still retain populations within their borders that exist on a dollar a day or less. While there are many factors that play into the reasons for why we still see poverty in the world, is there any connection to religious belief or practice? Max Weber famously argued that the reason why Europe industrialized first and experienced the subsequent rise in living standards was due to a Protestant ethic. Can we see evidence for such a hypothesis in our contemporary era? My guest today, Professor Rebecca Shaw, is in the midst of conducting some fascinating research that may shed light onto this connection between religious belief and practice and long-term economic outcomes. As we will see, she has studied the effect that tithing, as well as Pentecostal religious beliefs, have had on the economic fortunes of women in the slum areas surrounding Bangalore, India. Rebecca is a research fellow with the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University, and currently serves as the project leader of a research initiative on religion, entrepreneurship, and economic development in the modern world entitled Holy Avarice, Religion and the Reenchantment of Modern Capitalism, funded by the Religion and Innovation in Human Affairs Program of the Historical Society in Boston. She will be working with me on an upcoming project that seeks to explore the connections between religious liberty and social flourishing, something that I expect you all to be hearing about in the future. We will provide a link to Rebecca's homepage at the Berkeley Center, and it would be worth your time to pay a visit there, as there's a lot of neat things going on out there in Georgetown. Becky, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Hey, before we get into the specifics of your study, I have to ask about the title of that religion and innovation topic that you're working on. The main title is Holy Avarice, which only makes me want to cry out, Holy Avarice, Batman! But it's not about bats, it's not about men, and there's not even any robins involved. But rather, it's about the relationship between faith and entrepreneurial activity. So I have to ask then, why do you use the word avarice, which is synonymous for greed? Are you linking the reenchantment of capitalism with a religious revival of greed, for lack of a better term, as Gordon Gekko might say?
Well, not really, but holy avarice is an excellent word, isn't it? It elicits different reactions from people. Some people love it, and some people absolutely hate it. Actually, the term holy avarice comes from the teaching of the English Puritans one of the English Puritan preachers in the 17th century, where at the time a revolution was taking place towards people's attitudes to wealth and riches. And riches were losing their neutral quality. I mean, they were being seen as a positive good. People were urged to go out and make money, to have godly thrift. And one of the preachers actually says, go out and have holy avarice. Go and use your abilities, use your skills to accumulate wealth. People were encouraged strongly to go out and make money, and 6 days on 6 days of the week, and on the seventh day they gave it to God. So the Holy Avarice Project, in a sense, is concerned with looking at, with this sort of historical background, is concerned with looking at whether Christian entrepreneurs today, and I look at micro-entrepreneurs as well as high-net-worth Christian entrepreneurs, and asking, are Christian entrepreneurs so involved in their enterprise to the extent that they find themselves unable to live religious lives, unable to be involved as Christians? Are they trapped, you know, in what we call the, in what actually Weber called the iron cage? And we say, are they trapped in the iron cage of modernity? And our project asks Christian entrepreneurs, very wealthy, high net worth, millionaire Christian entrepreneurs, and we also ask poor micro entrepreneurs, to what extent does their Christian faith shape their business enterprise? Can the very Christian faith that gave rise to modern capitalism actually be responsible for bringing these people out, re-enchanting the cage? So that's where the term comes from. It's a fascinating. It's a fascinating historical period, and I love the term Holy Avarice, and I thought it fit the project.
It does. Now that I understand the explanation for it, I never knew this, and one of the things I love doing this program is I get to learn all these new things. So I can imagine some pilgrim way back on Plymouth Rock giving a sermon about ye avarice, go out and ye search it, for lack of ye better term. In some respect, a Gordon Gekko version of a pilgrim in that regard. So that's fascinating. It's also fascinating that you're looking at both rich Christian entrepreneurs, folks who have really done well in their lives, as well as poor individuals, and see what role religion plays in their life, seeing if there's a connection, because I don't think many people do that. When we look at the poor, we just tend to look at the poor and say, well, the poor are poor because they're poor. We never ask that obverse question, is, well, why do the wealthy get wealthy? Is there something involved there? And so you're doing both of these with that project.
Yes, and it's very interesting because, in a sense, the poor have more at stake. They work in small businesses, micro businesses. We're talking about very little money involved here. They would run a small, say, a business selling fruit on the side of the road, or man a telephone booth, cell phone booth, a cell phone charging facility. So we're talking about very small profit margins, if at all, and very little capital investment. And what do they do with that money? How do they invest it? Do they do they fritter it away on frivolous sort of entertainment, buying alcohol, or do they invest it wisely? And then we look at high net worth entrepreneurs and seeing to what extent does their Christian faith influence the way they run their businesses. And there are a lot of similarities, and I'm just really excited to look at these two different groups of people at, one might say, the either end of the economic enterprise spectrum.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. One of the other observations that you made in the question that in your response to the question that I asked, was that people note that, especially pastors, that if somebody is desperately poor, they have very little time for faith in their life. They're just basically trying to scrimp by until the next day. And as you do become wealthier, one, you have more time to engage in religious activities. But number two, as you mentioned, you build a pool of wealth, and that wealth can be tithed over to the church and used for other activities as well.
Absolutely. And many of the entrepreneurs, as we get into talking, I'll tell you about the role of tithing in the lives of the very poor entrepreneurs. But in terms of the role religious faith plays in the lives of some of the wealthier entrepreneurs that I've interviewed all over the world, is that it's indispensable for them. I mean, without their Christian faith, they really do not see themselves as being able to continue in their particular businesses. It's very tough for them to put human well-being before profit, but in a way, their Christian faith has really helped them do that. And they are very successful entrepreneurs. I mean, we are talking about people who are leaders in their field. So And yes, they do tithe, and some of them, and give very generously, very actively involved in poverty alleviation programs in their parts of the world. So, yes.
And that's also a great observation. I do want to return here to the poor for a minute, but just to stay with the wealthy, one of the things that I do when I teach political economy is point out to my students that a wealthy entrepreneur oftentimes gives back to the community in ways that you never expect. When I say, well, does a wealthy entrepreneur give back to a community? Most of my students automatically think, well, that's charity. They earned a big profit from their business, and then they drop it off in a tithing box or send it to the Red Cross or whoever it might be. But in reality, they're building a business. They're providing products and services that people want. They've used their time and energy doing that. They actually are providing something very valuable for the community as well.
Absolutely. And the ways in which they give back, I mean, we could spend hours on talking about this. The ways in which they give back is not just in terms of tithes or donating their money, giving their money, writing it off, as it were, but the way in which they look after their staff, mm-hmm. the way in which they set standards for not being involved in corrupt practices and being leaders in that field is a very important example for the business community. If you are the leader of your field, but you produce a top quality good, but are unwilling to bribe to get your product passed by, say, the authorities, then you're setting a very important standard. So, in a sense, they are giving back to society and lifting them to a higher moral level, higher ethical level than others would. So, yes.
Well, let's get to our main topic of interest today, which is to look at the connection between religion and poverty. I will have to have you back to talk about religion and the wealthy, that part of the Holy Avarice Project later. But I want to look at how religious faith and practice enable some individuals to break out of this vicious cycle of poverty or this iron cage, as we talked about it. I think both you and I would recognize that the reason poverty persists in the world is really multifaceted. So when we talk about the religious role or the role that religion plays in breaking out of poverty, we're not saying that other factors are unimportant. We're just saying that this is one particular factor here. And in doing so, and you do this in a paper that you recently wrote for a conference out there in Washington, D.C., you tend to look at a specific angle of this why poverty persists question, and that's the relationship between consumption and savings behavior among the desperately poor. Tell me about this linkage between consumption and savings.
Well, the paper that I did, and actually the sort of the economic theory, as you will, that shapes a lot of work with the micro entrepreneurs, is intertemporal utility maximization. We won't get into that, but talking about the poor and asking, when one looks at the poor and when human beings in general, when we seem to undervalue the future, and the poor are no exception. In fact, they will put off today those investments that which could yield high returns for them in the future, and it's sort of inconsistent behavior, because when one thinks of consistent behavior, one thinks of investing in education or housing or healthcare that would maximize your utility and maximize your outcomes in the future. But the poor, what the poor do, it seems to me, and we see numerous examples of this, and I'll get into this in a minute, is that they spend all their money today, or they spend every and pre-commit their future. They mortgage their future, there's been studies that show that the poor in India, even though they make a couple of dollars a day, if they have a remaining 20 or 30 rupees, you'd think they'd go out and buy, say, milk or vegetables, or say, put it aside in a box for school. For the doctor's fees or something. No, they actually go out and they would buy alcohol or buy snacks or waste it on a movie. So, in a sense, that's what I'm talking about when I say that the poor put off today what they could put off investing in tomorrow by wasting their money today. So
yeah, and that's what you're talking about, this intertemporal, what was it that you called it? Because that was a fancy economic term there.
Intertemporal utility maximization.
Oh, my gosh.
Your today's self is selling out your tomorrow's self, in a sense. You know, your today's self is spending all the money that your tomorrow's self could utilize and use and gain utility from.
And that has to be rather difficult for, especially for the poor in a place like Bangalore. And we're going to talk about the communities that you look at here in a second, but you have some desperately poor communities that are right next to some very wealthy communities, and they have billboards up for buy this snack product, and oh, isn't this whiskey fantastic, and oh, coming out soon, Die Hard 5, and you look at that stuff, you say, well, I should have some of that too, and so you take your $2 a day that you get working at a cell phone charger place, and you know, you say, hey, I deserve a movie too, but in reality, you should be putting that away for your kid's education or for a potential doctor visit coming up soon.
Absolutely, because it's very tough. Because I mean, just to give you a quick background, and Bangalore is very advanced now. It's very economically advanced. I mean, we've got Infosys. There's very large technology companies set up in Bangalore. There are fancy malls. The signs of prosperity and sort of the Americanization, as it were, of the world is all around the poor and all around the slums. And so it is very hard to save your small amounts of money for the future. But what, in fact, it does is that if they do, when the poor don't save for the future and they don't put aside money, they, in fact, get further and further into debt, and they get trapped in poverty. And by not investing the future, the money they make today yields lower and lower returns tomorrow, and they get trapped in poverty. And it's very hard to get out of poverty psychologically. The poor person would feel, well, you know, there's absolutely no reason for me to even work, because you know, tomorrow is just going to be another day. I'm not going to make enough money. My family is still going to go hungry. We're still not going to be able to afford to send our children to school, so why even bother? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, it is very difficult for the poor to just muster up enough hope and belief that their future will be different.
Well, there is one way that they could get the resources to break out of poverty, and that's taking out loans. And that's one of the things that you discuss in your research, that loans are often available to poor folks to help them get through some of the rough times, you know, those doctor appointments or having to pay your rent in a time that it's difficult to get through. And I have to admit that as long as there has been money, there's always been people willing to lend money for a cost. And the propensity to borrow is not always a bad thing, because if you use the money that you borrow wisely to generate greater returns by investing in a business or something, that's all well and good. But not all loans are beneficial in that regard. And the poor use these in different ways, and they also receive loans from different individuals. That I found to be a very fascinating part of your paper, because it plays a central role in what you're talking about. Tell us a little bit about how the poor deal with loans, deal with lending. Who lends to them, and how do they use these loans?
Well, the poor that I'm talking about are what we call the enterprising poor. While they're not the very, very poor, they are the poor that have the capacity to work. But still, these are poor people with absolutely no collateral. They have no security behind them. They have nothing to enable them to participate in the credit market. They cannot take loans from banks or from any formal credit institutions. So there are really very few options available to the poor. And one is a good option and one is a not-so-good option. And the not-so-good option, which has been there for centuries, are money lenders. Mm-hmm. And money lenders, and this is sort of, India has, I think, one of the largest informal money markets in the world. And these money lenders prey on the poor, and they realize that someone needs money. Obviously, they're not making enough to pay for their for their food or for medical expenses, they come to the poor and offer them loans. And the rates of interest at which these loans are calculated vary. I mean, it's completely up to the discretion of the money lender. It could be interest calculated daily, weekly, monthly. It just could change. And the poor obviously don't even understand how this interest is calculated. They're just told, you've borrowed 1,000 rupees and you should pay me 150 rupees every week. And this could go on for months. Mm-hmm. And often if you look at how much they actually pay, some of them pay upwards of 70, 80, even 100% in interest. And it's terrible. And the second way...
Yeah, I have to admit, that can't be good for breaking out of poverty.
No, it doesn't. In fact, what it does is it pushes further into poverty. And you know, if in some cases, when people take very large loans, we are talking about 100, 200, 300,000 rupees, and they are victims of these very, very arbitrary interest rates, their children have to take over mm-hmm. the debt. So a child, a very poor child, and a child is born into debt because of this. And it's virtually impossible to break out of poverty.
Yeah, intergenerational transfer of poverty. Yeah.
And the second way in which the group that I studied got loans was through microfinance.
Mm, that sounds a little bit better.
Yes, and microfinance, again, we're talking about, you know, these people still don't have any collateral. They take loans, and it's the loans are given based, there are two types of loans. One is the loan comes from the savings that a group creates. So the groups that I work with were called sanghams, and sangham actually means a self-help group. So a group of 15 women get together, and for a couple of a year or maybe even 9 months, start saving their money. And using that money, they give loans to their members. And that's one type of loan, that microfinance loan. And the second type of microfinance loan that we worked with was the organization that ran it, Divya Shanti and Bridge Foundation, gave sort of entrepreneurs slightly larger loans, but the ability to repay that loan and whether a person repaid it or not actually had consequences for other members in their group. So if someone got a 20,000 rupee loan and she paid it back on time, then her group members were then all qualified to also get loans.
Ah. So,
and it wasn't a very, it was still quite steep, I mean, relative to the United States and relative to the formal credit market. I mean, we're talking about 18% interest rate, but again, they knew what they were, the interest rate that they were getting, they were monitored and so on, and it wasn't arbitrary, and no one was sort of chasing them down if they didn't pay money. And so there's microfinance loans and which are savings based, as well as which come externally from the lender, from the organization, and then of course there are these awful money lender loans. That's how people get loans.
One of the things I noticed too, that the microfinancing loans tend to be geared more toward investment opportunities, whereas many times the money lender loans tend to be on consumption, right? I just need to buy something, and that necessarily won't produce any revenue for the borrower to pay off later. But the microfinancing loans are really specifically designed to help people start a small business or keep their small business going or expand that.
Yes, a lot of the majority of the clients in our study who took microfinance loans actually took them to invest in their business, and if they took money lender loans, it was always because they needed it really urgently. They needed vast sums of money, and it was a sort of to deal with a medical shock. So they had to take a money lender loan. You see, in India, we don't have health insurance. There's no such thing as Medicare, Medicaid. There's Medicare. There's no such thing, no state provision, or like the NHS in England, there's no state provision for healthcare. And healthcare costs account for sort of 70% of out-of-pocket expenses for the enterprising poor. It really knocks them back. So yes, money lenders are always available when people need money for healthcare expenses. But yes, in our study, a majority of the people that took loans from the Sangam invested it in long-term investments, for business loans or to invest in their children going to college or to build a house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things that do have payoffs in the long term. Let's go ahead and talk about your case selection now. We've mentioned that you located your study in Bangalore, and you specifically located the study in several neighborhoods, which you could call slums or very, very poor neighborhoods in Bangalore. Tell us a little bit about your case selection. Actually, first start off a little bit more macro and tell us why India, then why Bangalore, and then the neighborhoods in Bangalore that you picked.
Well, the study, while the Holy Avarice study is a continuation of the study of microfinance clients, it actually started was funded initially 3 years ago by the Templeton Foundation, and the study was called Tithing and Thrift Among the Enterprising Poor in India. And we chose India partly because I was very comfortable with the context. I had worked there, I lived there, I speak the languages, and I chose Bangalore because of the reasons I told you about earlier. Bangalore was changing. We had these very, very poor neighborhoods, and then we had very, very wealthy parts of Bangalore, and I chose the slums because it was sort of as discreet a community as you could find. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask questions about faith and family. I asked questions about domestic violence, and I was very comfortable with these particular slums, even though a couple of them were some of the most violent slums in India. But I wanted to go to a place where I could ask questions without, you know, putting my life in danger. So that's why I chose these neighborhoods. It was also they were also neighborhoods where there were lots of outcasts and Dalits, which I can talk about later. But that's one of the reasons I chose the slums. Baglur is one of the slums, and Lingrajpuram and Williamstown. So these were three of the main slums that I worked in. And Baglur is a very interesting slum. It is probably one of the most violent slums in Karnataka and Bangalore. And many years ago, I'm going to say about 20 years ago, a few thousand people died because the woman who controlled the slums, Mari Muthu, was known as the Hooch Queen.
The Hooch Queen.
Hooch Queen, yeah. And she used to brew illicit liquor. I mean, we're talking about serious sort of moonshine, and 2,000 people probably died in that slum. And there was no inquiry, no police took anybody to jail because she was such a very powerful figure.
Yeah.
And it's a very violent neighborhood. There are gangs. It was the red light district of the city.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, there's still quite pockets of very dangerous parts of the slum. So I wanted to do research there.
Yeah, good
and,
for you.
Years, we saw some very interesting changes taking place in the slum, with an increase in the number of storefront Pentecostal churches, and I thought this would be a very good place to start and to look at the role of faith in the economic and social outcomes of the poor. So we started in this area.
I have to ask about this Hooch Queen, because I love the name Hooch Queen. It sounds like a country music song, or.
But that's what she was called by the papers.
Yeah, maybe like a character on the episode of Justified or something. They must have got rid of her, right? She killed.
Oh no! She died 2 years ago. I went to her. They had a sort of a memorial service, so to speak. And, she lived for a very long time. In fact, her grandson now runs the slum.
Wow.
She survived.
I guess that tells you a lot about the living conditions of the poor and how beholden they are to some of these corrupt or questionable power brokers, that you end up producing moonshine that kills 2,000 people, and people still show up to your memorial service and have your and have their grandson run the thing for the next several years. I mean, that's
absolutely
that's tough Scrabble life. What did you ever feel at very uncomfortable or in danger at any time in your research? I'm in awe of people who do those things that you do to go into some of these very difficult neighborhoods as a social scientist and say, hey, I'm here to poke around and ask questions.
No, not really, Tony, because you see, for years my parents moved from a very wealthy part. My father was an Anglican priest, and he moved from a very wealthy part of Bangalore, and my mother settled us all for the family in this very poor part of Bangalore about 30 years ago, because she wanted to work among them. So I grew up in that area, so okay. I knew the slum, I knew the people, I was very familiar with them. It was a very violent part of the town, but I was very comfortable, and I always asked their permission, and people were very open to talking about some of the very horrific things that happened to them. I ever feel uncomfortable in the slum?
Well, that you definitely are situated in a position that you can take advantage of your past experience, your language skills, to really probe into this neighborhood. The one thing that you just said surprised me, though. We're a program that deals with religion, so we want to talk about religion. But you said Pentecostal storefront churches in India.
Absolutely, it's a phenomenon that I noticed in sort of, I'm going to say, the last 5 to 7 years. In this very violent, notorious part of Bangalore, there was a sort of a growth, a massive, a dramatic, an exponential, if you were, growth of storefront churches. When I say storefront churches, I mean exactly that. When you think of a storefront in India or in the Global South, you think of a little room with a shutter, you know, an iron shutter that's pulled down. And if your listeners have been to this part of the world, they know exactly what I'm talking about. And churches, Pentecostal churches, and they didn't actually call themselves Pentecostal churches. They called themselves independent churches, but they were certainly had a Pentecostal in character, started cropping up all over the slum. And they were run by indigenous, that is, Indian pastors who were out there evangelizing and talking with the people in the slum. And people were being converted to Pentecostalism, or to which they didn't even call that Pentecostal. They'd been converted. They just called themselves converts.
Right.
And these churches have grown. In fact, we did a survey. For the 1 square mile that I surveyed, there were about 177 storefront churches. They were tiny little rooms. And, yes, so that was what was happening. And it was very interesting to look at the way in which this slum was changing. It's the whole sort of religious mapping of it, the religious character of it was changing.
Well, give us a sense for how big the Pentecostal population was there and what other religious traditions were in the neighborhood. I mean, when we think of India, I normally think of the Hindu tradition, and with the next biggest faith tradition there being Muslims. In terms of Christianity, I've usually associated Catholicism with India. And, you know, the fact that your father was an Anglican pastor, well, that makes sense. You got the British connections from the past, but Pentecostalism catches me by surprise, although it shouldn't, because Pentecostalism expanding. But what did the rest of the neighborhood look like spiritually?
Well, The slum was a very interesting mix. Now, another reason why we looked at the slum was it didn't really look a lot like the rest of Bangalore, because these people, the slum people, were very independent about their faith practices. They were mainly Dalits, and I'll tell you what Dalits were. Dalits are the outcasts, the lowest rung on the caste system. It literally means broken, the broken people, the Mahatma Gandhi called them Harijans, or God's children, but they were literally the lowest rung. So the slum was comprised of mainly of Dalits. And there were about, I was going to say, half of the slum were Hindus, about 15% of them were Muslims, and the rest were Christians, and there was a fairly large Roman Catholic population, about 10 to 12, and the rest were where Pentecostals and some, but I'm going to say 4 or 5% of mainstream, like Church of South India, Anglican Christians.
Okay.
But the number of Pentecostals was growing. I mean, before, 10 or 15 years ago, there were hardly any. And then this time when we looked, we're talking about at least 10 to 12% of the Christian population, 10 to 10% of the slum population, were what they called members of independent churches.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance to go to any of these Pentecostal services, or?
Yes, I did, and it's just they were fascinating services, because you know they're all in the vernacular, and the pastor himself was obviously a convert. They were mixed. There were some churches had mainly women, as you would see in Latin America, and some churches had men and women, but they were, most of the people attending the churches were illiterate. And when I say this, is they, because they were able to, despite having never been to school, they were able to quote extensively from the Bible, remember passages, huge passages from the Bible, sing. They were the women, these Dalit women that were otherwise excluded, kept on the periphery of society, were leaders in the church. They were leading the Bible studies. They were leading. They were preaching. And so it was a wonderful experience to go to these churches and to see what a transformation in the whole way these people understood themselves and conceived in themselves was taking place in the Pentecostal church. So, yes. I did go there. I attended quite a few fasting and praise meetings in the slums, run again by these Pentecostal converts. Yes, I did. I did attend, and if you ever come to India, I'd love to take you to these churches.
I would absolutely love to see it, because normally you think of Pentecostalism here in the United States, and you associate with Southern just parts of the country, the Holy Roller kind of environment. And, you know, obviously they've had the Azusa Street Revival in Los Angeles and places like that. But it's just something that I wouldn't picture in India. And so it just must have been a just absolutely fascinating experience to go
into. And we do have those, actually. And there's a two-tier system, actually, of Pentecostalism in Bangalore, because we do have those. Mm-hmm. We have very wealthy churches, like who are very, I mean, apart from the people attending the church, you'd actually think you were in America, because the way in which the pastor preaches, he speaks with an American accent, the songs they sing, the style of worship, it's very Western. And you have those churches, and there are quite a few of those,
mm-hmm.
and they're very popular. And then you have these storefront churches. And in fact, one of the pastors, when I interviewed him, he says, "I'm not Pentecostal. Don't call me Pentecostal, because then you associate me with them over the railway lines." No, I'm an independent church. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. No, that's absolutely fascinating. One of the other things you just mentioned, too, about these religious services, they tend to be populated by women. And that's one of the other things that you did with your study, was you focused on women entrepreneurs. Explain why women are important in your study, as well as the entrepreneurial life of many of these slums.
Well, the reason I focused on women was partly because the microfinance organization that I was working with, and I was, of course, looking at the role of Christian faith on the lives of micro-entrepreneurs. So they lent their money mainly to women. So that was one of the reasons, I worked with women. The second reason that I worked with women was that the women in the slums actually ran the households. There are three big problems that face women in the slums. One is alcohol abuse amongst their husbands, the husbands taking on other women, mistresses, marital infidelity, if you will. And thirdly is domestic abuse. So I wanted to look at the ways in which their Christian faith, in the middle of trying to run a business and support your family, how did their Christian faith help these women deal with these issues? So that was one of the reasons I wanted to talk to women. They were available. They were the ones who were running the family. They were the ones who were making the money. They were the ones who had taken the loans. And in many ways, when they made the money, they were the ones that were making the decisions or whether or not to tithe. They were the ones that would make the decision as to whether or not to send their daughters to school, whether to build a house or not to, or to rent a house. And so that's why I looked at women.
Yeah, and women tend to be more involved in spiritual life. I know from my own work in Latin America and reading the work of folks like Elizabeth Brusco, who's talked about the reformation of machismo in Latin America. It's women who get involved in religion, and then they drag their husbands into the church. It's us guys are kind of lazy in that regard. We're out, you know, boozing and womanizing, but it's the women who really play a very key spiritual role and a very key role in transforming the family life. And I would assume that's very similar in India.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in the slum, it was very important, because when the women got actively involved in the spiritual life of, I'm going back again to talk about my Pentecostal converts, when they got involved in the spiritual life of the church, of their church, and in their spiritual family, among their faith community, then what it did was it brought pastors, who were mainly men, into the home. Pastors would visit the house when otherwise their homes were closed, and these women were dealing with alcohol, the abuse of their husbands, domestic violence, behind closed doors. When they started attending church and being part of a faith community, the male pastors and the evangelists and the visitors came home and visited the house to visit the women. And after about 15 times of a pastor coming home and sort of seeing you drunk, seeing a husband drunk on the bed, or talking to the women about, well, oh my goodness, you have a black eye yet again, these men are sort of shamed into giving up what they do. Or at least there's a man who's able to talk to them about their behavior. It opens up the suffering and the trials that these women go through to the faith community. So yes, the women really being involved in the faith community and being involved in church and these Pentecost communities had a remarkable impact, not just on their economic outcomes, but also a lot on their family life, by opening their lives and bringing the faith community and the members and the pastors and the into the home.
Yeah, I can imagine how the transformative aspect of religion in the family life is going to play a very important role in the economic life. As Elizabeth Brusco, who I mentioned a minute ago, and we'll link to her book because I find it to be a fascinating book, found that, you know, once you get the guys to stop boozing and to stop running around, wow, all of a sudden you have a lot more money to spend in the household. And that allows you to do better things with the money. And that's where I want to take this next. I want to talk about your findings, and specifically what you find in relationship to tithing and economic development. Because this, for me, in your research, was a fascinating finding. I would think, well, you know, people say tithing, if you're giving your money away to the church, how could you possibly be keeping it at home to help your business or to help your family get a better foothold to get out of poverty? So what is this relationship between tithing and basically breaking out of the iron cage of poverty?
Well, what we found, I'll tell you briefly, what we found in our study was that the women who were very active in their faith community were ones who were regular tithers. And when we say regular tithers, they tithed once a week or at least once a month. And many of them talked openly about giving 10% of their income. Some would say they just gave a blanket amount of, so 10, 100 or 200 rupees. And what tithing did for them was it while being involved in the Sangam, the self-help group, was a sort of involuntary saving. They had to save because they were part of this group. Tithing was a sort of voluntary saving. They had made a vow to tithe, to give to God a certain percentage of their income. And so it was a sort of a voluntary self-control. They said they had promised they were going to give 10% to the Lord. So it limited what money was available to them, and it sort of controlled how they spent that money. It also made them more accountable, because, you see, they had owed it to God. And the word I use in the study And the word we talk about is kanike. And kanike in Tamil means more than just tithe. It means to make a vow. So they had promised God they were going to give him this money. And so they were going to be careful with the money they had left. Also, if you think of being poor and poverty as a sort of a closed system, by tithing, they were sort of expanding the system. They were opening up the system. They were bringing God into their lives. And even though they had very little money, when they tithed, it was as though they were saying, you know what, I am committing to God this money because I am confident that He will provide for me in the future. I have a hope that He will provide for me in the future because, you know, I am giving to Him. He is looking after me. It was as though it sort of was an expansion of their reality, a transcendent bank account, if you will. You know, He is going to look after me. I don't have to worry about tomorrow. He will look after me. I'm going to look after today. I'm going to give to Him what I promise Him. I am accountable to Him, and He will look after my tomorrow. So it was a very interesting, there were many reasons that these women gave, but these were some of the main reasons that they gave for being regular tithers.
One of the things that is very interesting about this. You just mentioned here two multifaceted things going on in the lives of these women. One is the institutional incentives. You talked about the Sangam, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, the Sangam, which is the community of entrepreneurs that monitor one another, right? And you start off your paper by talking about, oh, well, you know, they're sitting in a room and they have to be accountable to one another. So in a very sociological sense, they're very accountable to one another. The other thing that there's institutional incentives to be accountable to your church community as well. Did you get a sense for that? That when I tithe, I have to be more responsible in my life because when I show up for Sunday services, I can't let anybody down?
Absolutely. Because you see, they were leaders. These people became then leaders in their church community. And yes, they were giving money to God. So they had to be very careful about how they spent their money and how they invested in their children, and whether they were going to, the women were going to say, you know, I'm going to give the last 50 rupees, say, and gamble it on a yet another lottery ticket. No, you're absolutely right. There were, the church was, the faith community and the church was looking out for them, and they were responsible not only to their Sangam members, which was very important, but they were responsible to their church members. And they were witnesses in their community for their church.
And that just sets up a series of practices that I always have to be looking out in the future for people ahead of me. And those things probably transfer over into their other aspects of their lives, saying, oh, wait, I want to go to this movie tonight, but no, that's not going to be good for me a week later when I have to go to the doctor. So they have some experience with those practices. One of the things that we talked about a couple of weeks ago with a podcast with Carolyn Warner, and she was talking about generosity in Catholic communities and Muslim communities in Europe, was the role of ritual. And you mentioned this in your paper as well. And some of what we're talking about here in terms of, you know, I have to tithe on a weekly basis, has a ritualistic aspect to it. Now, Pentecostals don't like to say that they're into rituals. But nonetheless, you got a sense of this in these communities, that there is some kind of ritualistic behavior that also helps to transform their economic and social behavior as well. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And what's very interesting, Tony, about understanding Pentecostalism in this sort of in this South Asian context is that in many ways it's very similar to Pentecostalism in Latin America and other ways, but in some ways it's quite different. And in the one way in which it's very different is with the understanding of rituals. Now, one of the rituals that we noticed that was very common among our Pentecostal clients was that of fasting. And in the Tamil word is ubavakam. And these people would regularly fast. I mean, it was sometimes twice a week, but certainly once a week. And it was a very, it was sort of a very important for them to fast for two reasons. One, it was self-restraint. These people were, again, practicing this restraint. We are going to be very careful. We're going to start training ourselves to fast, to not waste. We're going to kind of understand the world differently. We're going to start fasting and be very careful about how we spend our money and how. And the second thing, second way in which fasting was very important was the way in which other people viewed them. You see, fasting is a common practice, a common ritual among Hindus. Mm-hmm. Muslims fast during Ramzan. Hindus often fast. And in a sense, these people were connecting with other members of their community. And I like to call it, they were building reputational capital.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so when they were fasting, you know, they were seen as, oh, this woman fasts. Her life has changed so much. She's fasting. We need to respect her.
Yeah.
And they became leaders in their community, which again sets them up to being very careful about how they spend their money, how they live their lives, how they invest in themselves. So fasting was a very important way for these women to build reputational capital.
That's fascinating that it sends a signal to the community, say, yes, I'm very much in charge or have self-control over my life. And it's also, fasting is a very public activity. Yes, you could do it at home with the doors closed and stuff, but when people say, hey, you want to go out for lunch, say, no, this is my fasting day. And it sends a signal about your reputation. I can also see how it, as you mentioned, it connects with other people in the neighborhood who do not share your faith tradition, because Muslims fast and Hindus fast, and people can say, oh, you're those strange Pentecostals, but wait a minute, you're fasting. We have something in common here. Is that going on? Has there been religious tension with the Pentecostals, or is there some relationship between these groups that also helps these Pentecostal women who are involved in microfinance?
Well, actually, that's what's wonderful and fascinating about this study and these people, is that there is really no tension. And again, fasting comes into play here, and the way in which these women carry themselves. See, these women do not want to separate themselves, and they don't see themselves as separate or and so different from their Hindu or Muslim neighbors, who are often, in many cases, their family members. And when they fast, they are in fact connecting at a very deep level with these women, because the women understand the practice. And sometimes when they fast, they have prayer meetings where everyone in the neighborhood comes to. The Muslim neighbors, who could be your Muslim sister-in-law, or the Hindu neighbors, and they have meetings together. So I did not see any serious tensions between religious groups and these women. But then again, we are talking about women.
Yeah.
I would imagine. I wonder if it would be the same if I were looking at men. So
yeah, men are different. I know that. So, but it is fast. Actually, building these bridges, that the things that women do, that can only be economically beneficial, because it's empowering not only for the individual person but for the community as well.
Absolutely, because what happens is these women are part of these, as I told you, sanghams or self-help groups, and they comprise of women from different faith communities. And sometimes when a woman is unable to pay back her loan, other members in the sangham, in the self-help group, actually pool together and pay the woman's, make the woman's loan repayment.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a strong, they build a strong community. And a strong bond between each other, which is, I think, goes beyond just social capital or trust. It goes to a deeper level.
And that's the other thing that you had mentioned a little bit earlier that I wanted to come back to. We were just talking here about the institutional incentives to, you know, save more, not to let your sangham down, not to let your church community down, to send signals to other people that you're trustworthy and can be a leader. Those are all at the economic level. But you mentioned a transformative aspect of all of this at the level of beliefs, that people felt more connected to God, they felt more self-empowered, and they had a greater sense of hope. And that, you cannot underestimate that in terms of looking at the future and trying to break out of poverty. Just having that hope, going from hopelessness to hope, is mattering here. That's what you're finding.
Absolutely. I mean, the poor and are caught in, as I mentioned earlier, in this poverty trap, you know, where they don't really feel inclined or motivated to work anymore or to work in the future, work because the returns in the future are so minimal. The prospects are so bleak. And in a sense, we look at faith as a way that propels these people out of this trap. It sort of propels them over the threshold to where they have where they have an opportunity to make a difference in the future. You know, to say to yourself, you know what, I'm actually going to take this loan and I'm going to invest it and I'm going to make something of myself. How does a person come to say that? We believe that they are able to say that is because they feel valued, and they feel valued because God values them. And they are part of a faith community, they're part of a church community where they are told that. You see, the Dalits for years suffered such marginalization, such rejection. I mean, in 1906, someone wrote about them as having the depressed class mentality, you know, so down on themselves that they felt they could do nothing. And so when you're involved with a God, with a faith community, you know, and believe that you're worth something, that you can make a difference, and that the future, that someone loves you enough, that your future matters, these people get up. I mean, microfinance loans, I want to be very clear, are very, very small loans. They are not the panacea. I mean, you're talking about very, very small loans. And in fact, many studies have been done which show that microfinance really on its own doesn't really yield much benefit. So it's what we found is the microfinance loans coupled with the strong faith and the goods that faith and religion bring to the poor is what propels them out of this trap, out of this feeling, this place where nothing you feel you can do will make any difference, to a place where, you know what, I'm going to invest. I have invested. My children are going to go to college. I'm going to build a home so I don't get turfed out next month and have no place to stay. I'm going to invest in my business, and I'm going to take charge. So religion and faith is very, very important alongside microfinance.
You know, being a person that's never been to India, and I don't study India specifically, but as a kid growing up, when you learned about different countries all around the world, one of the things that you learn about India is this caste system. And as you mentioned, the Dalits are the ones who are in these poor neighborhoods. And the caste system is always presented as something very rigid. And this is interesting because as countries modernize, as become more economically prosperous, one of the things that you begin to see is this fluidity or mobility between different classes. And one always has to wonder if this caste system is acting as an inhibitor toward that kind of movement. And I'm wondering if what you're seeing, not only the institutional incentives to become wealthier, but also this belief, this I have hope, I'm not stuck here because I'm stuck here, and the word of God promises me that there's greater things in store for me. Is that breaking down the caste system today?
Well, I don't know, but what I want to say is that it's sort of like one could understand racial discrimination and sort of racial stigma here.
Yeah.
But in terms of there's caste discrimination in India. And that will, I believe, continue. And what Christian faith does is it changes the person's own perception of him or herself, which they will always be a Dalit. They will always be, as the caste system prescribes, at the lowest rung of the caste system. They will always be a Dalit. They're never going to be a Brahmin. They're never going to be anybody else. But what they feel about themselves is going to change. And what they feel they can do about their future will change. we believe, as being which conversion brings, and what they feel about themselves, their own sense of who they are, because they are loved by God, they are part of a faith community, a faith network that believes in them, that supports them, that transforms what they can then do for themselves. So there are laws in India against caste discrimination, and I'm sure in the technology world in Bangalore, sitting next to a Brahmin software engineer is a Dalit software engineer, and so they are being employed. But no amount of laws will change how people understand themselves and how people treat, say, the Dalits. I don't know in North India, where the caste system is more entrenched, whether a wealthy landlord will ever have a Dalit sit at his table, however wealthy that Dalit may be, because the caste system is so entrenched. But what it does for the person and how the person understands himself and how the person sees himself, and that's what faith really, that's how faith changes someone, and that's how faith can really make a difference, I believe, in the lives of the poor.
That is a great way to finish off our podcast here as we near the end of time. But I do want to ask one more question, because this is an ongoing project and it's one that's absolutely fascinating. What next with this project? Where else are you taking it, and what other questions might you be asking?
Well, this was the first cut of the project. We did a sort of a baseline study, and we're hoping to look at sort of more specific ways in which faith can help the poor escape poverty. We're trying to look at, you know, we talked about loans. We're trying to look at whether faith can change the way in which lenders, say, perceive the risk of borrowers. If someone is a person of faith, is he or she less of a risk? You know, if you charge an interest rate, a high interest rate for someone who's, say, you can see as someone who's wasteful or a spendthrift. If someone's a person of strong faith, he or she goes to church regularly, you can see she's not drinking, will her interest rate be lower? Is there any way in which faith can help the poor sort of negotiate this credit market? These are some of the areas we're looking at. We're looking at long-term investments over time, how many children whose parents have invested in them who've come from these communities. What is that? Is that lifting the whole family out of poverty? And so we're looking at some of the long-term investments and the returns on those.
Well, we'll have to be keeping an eye on those projects and have you back to find out what you are finding in those projects. And one thing that I need to close with here is that during the course of this podcast, I received an email from you. This is, we're setting up our podcast and I sent things out and let you take a look at the introduction that I was writing about you. And you wrote back saying that, don't call me professor because I'm not a professor. I'm only a research associate. But over the course of the past hour, you have actually taught me a lot. So I think that moniker of Professor Rebecca Shaw actually is very well suited for you. And I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion today.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.